web services.
Welcome to the Cloudonaut podcast. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Willi. We have been building on AWS since 2009. You can follow along as we develop products like BucketEV, Marbot and HyperEnv, and you can learn from our practice. This is episode number 87, and we are recording this on the last day on February in 2024. So in course you're watching this live on YouTube or LinkedIn, feel free to ask your questions and we will answer them either directly or at the end of the show. So Andreas, what are we talking about today? Do you have anything that you want to share with us?
Yes, I have. So Michael, so I have recorded a video and published a blog post this week. So it is about how to reduce costs with GitHub Actions. So the thing is, I think it was last year, Michael, that we migrated our projects from CodePipeline to GitHub Actions. Is that right?
Yes, I think so.
Because we just, so I would say the main argument for that was that the user experience with GitHub Actions is quite good because you have your code and your CI/CD pipelines all in the same place. And so with CodePipeline and GitHub and everything mixed up, it was always quite challenging to get an overview of what's going on there. So that is why we switched. And but then when we basically had transitioned all our projects to GitHub Actions, we soon noticed that it's getting quite expensive, actually, because when you're using GitHub Actions and you're using the so-called GitHub-hosted runners, so the machines that run your CI/CD jobs, then you have to pay, of course, for those runners. It's by minute. And depending on your GitHub plan, some minutes are included or not, so that depends. So all changed a little bit, I think, when Microsoft changed the pricing plans. But depending on your plan and the number of minutes you are using, GitHub Actions can become quite expensive over time. So I think at the end, when we started to investigating this, we paid a few $100 per month just for our CI/CD pipelines. And yes, we have some long-running pipelines, but we are only two developers, right? So there's not crazy amount of coding going on, so just the two of us. So how can we reduce our monthly GitHub bill? And recently I found quite an interesting tool from Sandro. So he developed what is called Octolens. So this is a small GitHub application, and it allows you to get insights into your GitHub Actions usage, because all what GitHub is offering is basically offering you the total amount of minutes that you consume, the build minutes, and you can download a CSV report, which is not that handy, to be honest. So the cool thing what Sandro is building with Octolens is a very simple application that you can just install, and then it gives you insights into how much build minutes you're using, and especially important, it shows you which repositories and which workflows consume the most build minutes. So this is a great place to look into when you want to start optimizing your workflows. So often there's maybe, I don't know, room for improvement to improve the time it takes to build something. And you can find those areas where it makes the most sense to take action. So yeah, Octolens is what I can highly recommend. And I've, as I said, I recorded a video, so find it on YouTube in our channel, or I've written a blog post where I summarize all of that. So if you're interested into details, check that out. And the other thing is, so back then, when we noticed that we need to find a way to reduce our GitHub Actions costs, we also started HyperEnv. So this is our solution to deploy self-hosted GitHub runners on AWS. So instead of using the infrastructure that GitHub provides, you basically bring your own virtual machines. And with HyperEnv, we aim to make that as easy as possible to deploy that to your own AWS account. And then the whole thing runs on EC2 machines, and a HyperEnv just starts EC2 machines on demand, so you're only paying for what you use. The machine is only running for the builds that you are doing. And so as a rule of thumb, that is, by using Hyperenv, you can reduce your GitHub action spending by 30% roundabout, including the AWS infrastructure costs, of course. So those are the two tools that I discussed in the blog post and the video, how you can reduce your GitHub action spending.
Yeah, that's great. And Andreas, there's someone in the, on LinkedIn who agrees with your kind of experience of GitHub actions. So, yeah, It's really, I mean, if it's really easy to use and super easy to, if things go wrong, it's super easy to find the reason for that. And so, yeah, it's a great addition to what GitHub offers besides just the pipelines. I mean, they still have very great ways of collaborating on code. So I like the pull request feature still. So we use it on a daily basis. It's really one of the tools that we kind of rely on every day, Andreas, right? So, and happy customers, to be honest.
Yeah. And that brings us to our next topic, Mike.
Yeah.
So, because we have been working on a CI/CD pipeline quite a lot during the past week.
Yeah.
So the thing is, so that's a pipeline for Bucket AV.
Yeah.
So maybe let me give you an introduction, and then you can go through the pipeline how it works in detail. Yeah. So the thing is, Bucket AV is a product that we sell in the AWS marketplace, and what we need to do to basically release a new version is we need to provide an Amazon machine image, an AMI, and we need also to provide CloudFormation templates, because those two are basically the deliverables that we then upload to the AWS marketplace. So that is basically the scenario. And this process was more or less manual, but as we are doing it about once a month, we wanted to take action and automate that thing. And that's also because AWS is currently adding more and more API calls, allowing you to do that automatically. So we are hoping that also this will be able for AMI and CloudFormation products in the future. It's already available for some of their product types in the marketplace. So that's why we think it's a good time to start working on the automation part. So, Michael, can you talk us through how we implemented a CI/CD pipeline for Bucket AV?
Yes, I do. And I wanted to add one kind of motivation for why this was actually also important, because just the last release that I created for Bucket AV powered by Sophos, I made a mistake. So I copied a wrong, basically, URL for where the CloudFormation template lives. So I submitted the wrong templates to AWS accidentally. I mean, I noticed it because we always review then when they create a new release, But this was kind of human error, right? And this is also, I mean, it's something that we should kind of optimize and reduce. So that's why we also created this kind of automated approach. One thing to add is that all the pieces that we kind of connected together were already automated. For example, the AMI creation was already automated. Testing was already automated. Basically, what was missing was kind of connecting everything together to kind of create a new release. So let me walk you through how it works. So one thing to know is that Bucket AV lives in one single Git repository hosted on GitHub. So we have the core product in there. We have what we call add-ons. We also have other things that we use internally. It's all in a single bucket. So to kind of create a new release, what you basically do is you create a Git tag. And then for us, because we have two variants of our product, one for Claim AV and one for Sophos, you can, for example, tag the Git repository with the tag Claim AV. And what I did in the morning is I created a tag Claim AV version 2.18.0. So that will be our next release that I submitted to AWS Marketplace. And then you push that commit up to GitHub, what happens is that the GitHub action is triggered. And this GitHub actions first runs our static analyzer, so it validates our JavaScript code, it validates our CloudFormation templates, it runs the unit tests. So that's kind of the very quick check if everything is kind of in good shape. Then it creates the Bucket AV executable, and it's Our application is implemented in Node.js, but you can create a binary with Node.js, and that's what we basically ship later into the AMI. That's the next step where we create the AMI. And we use Packer for that. So we add our binary and we add the engine, so either the ClamAV engine or the Sophos engine, and we work kind of everything else that we need to make it work. CloudWatch agent, for example, a couple of configuration files, of course, things like that. We install the latest patches and so on and so forth. And then we generate CloudFormation templates for our product using the CDK. So our templates are, or we use the CDK to kind of implement everything that we need, and then we use it to kind of synthesize the CloudFormation templates. So this is kind of, now we have all the pieces in place. Because the templates require the AMI as an input, and we can now kind of spin off BucketDB. And that's what we do in an automated way. And then we run our integration or acceptance test against this. So then this is then really spinning up AWS infrastructure. And we have, I mean, long time ago, we started with a JUnit based project, like using the Java language. And we adopted that and adopted it. And we use it in BucketDB as well. So that's why the acceptance tests are implemented in Java using the JUnit framework. But it's really not about the language so much. It's just we create a lot of CloudFormation stacks. And then we kind of, for BucketDB case, we upload a file to an S3 bucket. And we see if it's, for example, tagged as infected or something like that. So we kind of assert everything that should happen. That's kind of it. Next step, once that actually is successful, of course, if it fails, we will not continue the pipeline. But once it is successful, we prepare a release for AWS Marketplace. And this requires a couple of things for us. For example, we have to upload the CloudFormation templates to a specific bucket. And we also have to share our AMI with an account from Amazon. So copy the AMI to them, basically hand it over. And then, unfortunately, the last step that Andreas talked about is then kind of submit this information to AWS Marketplace. And that's not yet a part of their API. So they are kind of expanding on that area, but our product type, which is an AMI with CloudFormation, is not yet possible. So basically, at this point in time, we just output all the information that we need to then kind of manually, and this is not a joke, we have to submit an Excel sheet with thousands of columns. And we submit this to AWS Marketplace, and then they kind of import it somewhere and then kind of process our request. So the last step is definitely something that we want to automate as well, because here we can make errors, still make errors. But we hope that someday they release this API, and then we can kind of finish our release pipeline here.
Yeah. Michael, I want to add one thing. So you talked about our acceptance tests that spin up the CloudFormation stacks and basically see if the application works as expected. But one aspect that is crucial for us is, so we sell the product through the marketplace and our customers install it in the region of their choice. So we need to make sure that our product works in all the regions available. And that's why we also spin up a test in all of the regions, actually, to make sure the product works there. Because we noticed that, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit in the next section, that the regions have small but important differences from time to time. And you cannot rely on a product working in the same way in every region. So that is why we have to test basically in every region if the product is working, and that's what we do as well. And that's also why the acceptance test takes quite some time, because we spin up a lot of different configurations in different regions, and this takes quite some time to get that done. So that's a little bummer, but it's the only way to be sure that the product will work for all of our customers.
And if you say quite some time, I think we can be fully transparent, right? I mean, it takes 3 hours. The full run takes 3 hours. It is already kind of paralyzed in some ways, but the problem is that for example, we use a lot of CloudFormation APIs, and CloudFormation has very tough rate limits, so you cannot send a lot of create stack resources operation, so we can most likely send one per second. And if we have 8 tests running in parallel, it could be that we create 8 stacks in parallel. And then those stacks also make a lot of API calls, right? Like CloudFormation spins up a lot of VPCs then and auto-scaling groups and alarms. And so the problem is that at this point, if we increase the parallelization from 8 to 16, for example, our tests will be actually not faster because we just run in all these rate limits and everything starts to retry and it's not going faster. What we maybe in the future have to do, Andreas, is use multiple AWS accounts or use multiple regions to run everything kind of not only parallelized, but kind of parallelized in different AWS accounts. So kind of to share or not to share the rate limits. Yeah. But it's on our list, right?
Yeah, another thing is the quotas. So we have to make sure that we can create enough VPCs and spin up enough EC2 instances in parallel and stuff like that. So that's also challenging, especially as you run acceptance tests, maybe not only for the release, but also for pull requests or something. Yeah, so that's quite a lot going on there. But I think still, I'm really proud of this automation and the depth that we go into the testing, because it ensures that when we ship a new release, we catch problems in our code before it reaches our customers. And that makes really, it's really important for delivering a quality and be a reliable partner for our customers.
Yeah, I'm also very proud of the test suite, to be honest. And I fully rely on it. So I have very high confidence in it. I know that the feature that I'm working on at the moment will require me to add a lot of new tests because it involves multiple AWS accounts for cross-account activities. So I have to add a couple of more tests, Andrea, so it will be getting slower and slower.
Maybe we need to think about that concept of using multiple accounts.
Yeah, so maybe we have to optimize soon, but at the moment it's not perfect, but it's okay. And we can live with it. So I usually work on two or three features in parallel, so I have always a couple of tests running in parallel. And that's also why our GitHub build was so high, right? Because we have really tests that run for 3 hours and then we run them a couple of regions and then we have 9 hours built basically that we pay for GitHub and then it gets expensive. I think at one month we paid a 4-digit, like $1,000-something to GitHub. Yeah, so it definitely made sense for us to optimize there. I mean, for our company, we are a small company, it is also a big part of our monthly spending, basically, for infrastructure. So there's one question, Andreas, on LinkedIn around Packer versus Image Builder. And I think you have some expertise in that region, right? I think, I don't know if you wrote a blog post about it or you...
I wouldn't call it expertise, but I'm using a lot of Packer, so that's for sure. So whenever I need to build AMIs, I'm using Packer. And in general, I like also the approach of building AMIs for all kinds of workloads. I'm using it, for example, not only for BucketEV, but for projects where we set up pipelines for, let's call it legacy software that runs on EC2 machines and cannot be easily containerized. So that is when we use Packer a lot. And Packer is a very flexible tool. So that's what I like about it. It's simple to use and very flexible. The AWS Image Builder, in contrary, is also a tool to build AMIs, but I think it's not as easy to implement or to integrate it into a CI/CD pipeline. So I think the idea behind EC2 Image Builder is more that you build golden, what AWS often calls golden AMIs, to provide a certain standard AMI for your organization. And it runs on its own, and it doesn't, I couldn't find a good way to integrate it into a classical CI/CD pipeline as we do it. So it's more if you have the thing just to build your AMI without any repository with code or something in it. So I think that's the main use case for the EC2 Image Builder. So I would expect that the Image Builder is more used from ops teams that want to have, I don't know, an Amazon Linux with some pre-installed and configurized stuff. But it's typically not used for building AMIs, including your application, because bundling your application into the AMI is, I think, much easier with Packer than it is with EC2 Image Builder. I could not find an easy way to accomplish that.
Okay, so if you have, like, if our, like, audience has different kind of experience of it, maybe it changed also over time, like, let us know, and maybe we can kind of revisit it if you know that there's something, like, game-changing happened in the past. Yeah, but basically the reason why we use Packer is that because we used it before and it's working very well for us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Michael. So let's jump to the second section of this podcast, which is about going over the latest AWS news and seeing your reaction on it. So I've prepared a few news items that I picked, found interesting for some reasons, and I just want to get your first reaction on that. Okay, let's go. So the first one is AWS Systems Manager Parameter Store now supports cross-account sharing. So,
yeah, I think I can see where this gets useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. So, yeah, you can share secrets or other kinds of parameters with other accounts with your whole organization. It works using the AWS Resource Access Manager. So it's not just a resource policy. I think with Secrets Manager, the alternative to the parameter store for storing secrets, there you have the resource policy attached to each secret. With the parameter store, you can share any parameter by using the Resource Access Manager, which is basically its own service that you can, that you have to use. Also, so that makes it a little, I don't know, it's a little more complicated to use, I would say. You need to set that up, but it works. And then there are a few other requirements. I looked into it. So I didn't know, actually, that there are two types of parameters in the parameter store. There's the standard parameter, and there are advanced parameters. I didn't know about that, Michael. And the advanced parameters, so what they come is, I think it's about the rate limit that you can access those parameters. And you pay a little more for the advanced ones. Basically, I think the standard ones are free. I don't think you pay. I couldn't find you. I think it's basically just free. But the advanced one, you have 5 cents per parameter per month, and then you're paying for requests as well. So that is the difference. And you need an advanced parameter to be able to share it. You can, by the way, change the type of a parameter from standard to advanced if you want to. And another difference between standard and advanced is, I think standard is 4 kilobytes and advanced is 8 kilobytes. So that's the huge benefit of going in the other tier. Then also important, if you use a secure string, so basically a secret in the parameter store, and you want to share that with another account, you need to use a KMS key, a customer managed KMS key, because then you need to make sure that the other account has access to the key as well. So that is also important. And yeah, so I think, yeah, could be useful. I have no concrete use case right now, but from time to time, it might be useful to share your parameters with other accounts.
I have two kind of, one question and one kind of addition. Like, the difference between if you shared using RAM versus you shared with the resource policy is that if you shared via RAM, it really appears in the UI of the other account, right? It will be visible just as a parameter there. At least that's how it works for VPC subnets and that kind of stuff. With a resource policy, you have, like, from the other account's perspective, you don't really know that this secret exists and you have access to it. Like, you have to kind of know it from, like, outside of your account knowledge, basically. My other question is, I mean, I'm not sure if you know it, Andreas, but how do I access it? Because, I mean, they cannot just use the name, right? I mean, it could be that the parameter name is already taken in my account. So how does this work? Is it prefixed with something, or do you know that?
Do you need the ARN? So where the account ID is in the ARN, and then you access it by the ARN.
Okay.
Is that possible?
Yeah. I mean, it's possible, probably. Yeah, but because a lot of APIs use the path, basically, so there's no ARN in there.
Question.
So, yeah. Okay, yeah. Good question. I mean, it's a detailed question. Sorry for that. Yeah.
No problem.
All right.
Okay, so next news is AWS Resource Explorer supports 65 new resource types.
That's great. I must admit, I'm not using Resource Explorer because it missed so many resources at the beginning. So I probably will not notice that now 65 new resource types are supported. But yeah, I mean, Yeah. It's
I think
it's
that's great. That's the problem with the service. So if the coverage is not 100%, the tool is not very useful. And so either they implement all of the resources or they can just stop it. So
yeah, or they let me know when they are done. Like they can have a press release. Okay, we now implemented everything. You can now use it. So let me know.
Okay, the next one is also cool. I think the API gateway now supports TLS 1.3.
Okay, I think that's kind of what this is actually what Werner all referred to heavy lifting. So I mean, I don't care much. It's nice that it is added. It was probably a lot of work. And thanks for doing that, AWS. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really cool example of what it's when you use serverless architectures. They just optimize over time without much effort on our side. So TLS 1.3. So why is it important? So first, it's about performance. So basically, setting up the TLS connection is taking less time. And also, they have security improvements in there. For example, also TLS handshakes only support ciphers with perfect forward secrecy, and other things that I don't understand are implemented in there. Yeah, so that's cool. So it's available for all regional REST APIs, HTTP APIs, and WebSocket endpoints. It's not available for private APIs yet, and there's a little confusion in the documentation and the announcement. So the documentation says it's supported for edge optimized REST APIs as well. The news doesn't mention that. So I'm not sure, but probably the documentation is more accurate here. Yeah, so check that out. So it should be available by default. And then the last one, Michael, a new AWS region in Mexico is in the works.
Yeah, I mean, that's always great. I like it. I mean, I probably will not run the workload there because probably the latency will be very high from Germany. But I mean, for our customers, for example, for BucketDB, it's great if they can run it close to their workloads. Yeah. What did you say? What's the estimated opening date?
So they plan to open it in early 2024. 25. Sorry.
Okay. So next. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. 1 year. Yeah, okay.
And by the way, they have 5 new regions in the works now. So one more in Germany, Malaysia, Mexico, and New Zealand, and Thailand. So that's the 5 that are currently in the building. So
the German one in the building is this government thing, right?
Probably, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing that I was thinking about, so a challenge is, so we discussed it when we talked about the BucketDB pipeline, that there are little differences between the different regions. And for example, services or features get deployed step by step in all those regions. So I was wondering, so how many regions can they add until they basically really have a very big challenge for keeping them in sync and rolling out their features there? So that is, I'm interested in seeing where we will end up in maybe 5 years. So when will they stop adding new regions and then maybe growing them? But that's also not a good idea, probably. So it's a really challenging situation, actually. So looking forward. I
mean, maybe they hope that in the future not so many new customers will sign up and then the problem goes away. So
don't think so, Michael.
But yeah, I mean, what really is the problem, what we notice like from like a user perspective of AWS is that, yeah, we know regions are different, but what also kind of blow my mind is that when they release a new region and then they release a new region a couple of months ago, they are different in different ways. So for example, The latest region that was released is a Canada region, Canada West 1 or something. And for example, one of the APIs that we use, AWS Marketplace Metering API, I know it's a very niche kind of thing, but it's not available there, right? They haven't deployed it there. We have never seen that in any other new region that was deployed before. It just doesn't exist there. And this is a new kind of difference compared to all the other region releases. And the other one that I talked about before is there's one, like, I don't know how it's called, cost optimized whatever strategy for running spot fleets and with an autoscaling group. And that feature was not there for, I think, 2 or 3 of the latest regions that were released. And then a couple of months later, it was just there without a kind of announcement. So this was kind of the same for all the new regions, but this the API endpoint for the metering API was just missing for the latest region. So I will be very excited to see what's missing in Mexico or what kind of new problem they introduced there for us.
Yeah, so probably 99% of all AWS customers never noticed that because they are not using all the regions, of course, and especially not the latest ones. But for us who are really working in all regions, that's always a challenge. Yeah. Yeah, perfect. That's it. We'll be back soon. Subscribe to our newsletter, the podcast, or the YouTube channel to make sure you're not missing the upcoming shows. And we're looking forward to your feedback. hello@cloudonaut.io or find us on LinkedIn and Mastodon. As always, you will find all the links in the show notes or the video description. Thanks a lot for listening and watching.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Bye. Have a great day.
Bye.